This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Since 1969, Rolling Stone magazine has brought you the finest in award-winning articles and pop culture news. Brilliantly covering diverse hot-button topics, all while reporting the finest in fashion, food, humor, and technology. But it's still Rolling Stone's long-respected history of covering the music and entertainment industry that keeps them as one of the world's most read magazines. It's Rolling Stone Magazine, coming up next on the Audio Reading Service.
Welcome. This is Rolling Stone, and I'm your reader, Christine, with the Audio Reading Service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from the September issue, copyright 2025, by Rolling Stone, LLC. And I'll begin with this month's Rolling Stone interview, David Byrne. Am I ever going to get this figured out? By Simon Wojcik Levinson. David Byrne strolls into his downtown Manhattan office around noon and promptly removes all of his footwear. He's been in this pre-war building only for a few months, but it's already unmistakably his own, looking as much like a workspace as it does like a museum of the unusual items he's collected throughout his decades as one of pop's most curious minds. Meticulously organized metal shelving lines one long wall full of music books, art books, history books, and enough DVDs to put the Criterion closet to shame. An Oscar, a Grammy, and an MTV Video Music Award are positioned unobtrusively among kitschy treasures like an ancient can of macadamia nuts with Spam and a cassette of a speech by Bob Dole. It took a while before everything was up and on the bookshelves, he says, but once that happened, it was like, okay, we're home again. Not long after we finished talking, Byrne will head into rehearsals for a 50-date North American tour in support of his excellent new album, Who is the Sky? At 73 years old, he's as full of restless energy as ever, eager to talk about the creative process behind this album, which he made with top 40 producer Kid Harpoon, or about his recent onstage collaborations with stars like Olivia Rodrigo. He's also well aware that much of the world would rather see him perform with Talking Heads, the peerlessly inventive rock group he led with bass player Tina Weymouth, drummer Chris Frantz, multi-instrumentalist Jerry Harrison, before splitting under less than friendly circumstances in 1991. Byrne has also built an impressively flexible solo career since then, making catchy and fascinating records with a widely varied cast of collaborators and selling out hundreds of nights on Broadway with his 2019 American Utopia show. But none of those triumphs got the public more excited than the promotional appearances he made last year with Weymouth, France, and Harrison for an A24 re-release of Stop Making Sense, the 1984 concert film that is in many ways Talking Heads' magnum opus. Anyone who's hoping to see Byrne reunite with Talking Heads is out of luck. At least they can look forward to seeing brilliantly reworked versions of some of their favorite songs in Byrne's current stage show. I can mix and match and have it adapt to the sound that I'm doing at the moment without completely destroying the integrity of the older songs, he says. But I'm also aware that there's a real trap. If you do too much of the older material, you become a legacy act that comes out and plays the old hits. You cash in really quick, but then you've dug yourself a hole. Following is the question and answer between Wojciech Levinson and David Byrne. Question: the title of your new album originated in a misheard phrase, right? Byrne replies, yes, somebody was sending me a text using voice-to-text, and the algorithm got it a little bit wrong. And what came up on my phone was, who is the sky? And I thought, that's a beautiful phrase. I know what they were really saying. It's pretty easy to tell, in English anyway. But I thought, I'm going to put that on the list of album titles. And I realized that it fit in other ways. There's a lot of songs where I'm asking, who am I? Who is this? What is that about? Why do we do this? I also had this thought that the image on the record cover would be me partly hidden. So, who is this guy? Question: that's an interesting question to ask about yourself this far into your career. It's not a debut album. Reply: you'd think at my age I would know who I am. But no, we're always still figuring it out. Figuring out who we are and where we belong and how we feel about things. We'll never really know all the answers. You have a great song on this album called My Apartment Is My Friend. Were you thinking of a particular apartment? Byrne says, I was thinking of my apartment, where I live now. During COVID, I tried to write songs and wasn't really able to write much. I wrote words for a song called 6 Feet Apart or 6 Feet Away about seeing someone, but you can't get any closer than 6 feet because of social distancing, and you couldn't see this person's face because of the mask, that kind of thing. I sent the words to John Mulaney and said, what do you think? There was a line about, she had Purell in her purse. He liked that, but I never used it. I thought, what's happening? It's serious. This is not a joke. There's ambulances parked outside my building. The sirens are going day and night. But after it all passed, I came up with these words for, my apartment is my friend. The pandemic was a harrowing time here in New York, but you got a song that feels positive and uplifting out of that? Byrne says, yeah, this is how I felt. My apartment is cradling me. I know I'm the only one there. No one else is visiting. I'm going to watch an old movie on streaming at night, and I'm going to cook something that I haven't tried to cook before. And I don't know how messy it looked. There'd be a big temptation to just be like, well, it's my mess. How long have you lived in that apartment? Not that long, relatively speaking. Maybe 15 years now. It might seem fairly long, but I've lived in New York for a long time. Do you remember what your first apartment in New York was like when you moved here in 1974? Well, when I first moved here, I slept on the floor of an artist's loft. He had just gotten it, and the deal was room and board for helping him fix it up. Sand the floors and paint and build a loft bed for him and all that kind of stuff. That was an entree. And then eventually, I moved into a loft nearby with two of the Talking Heads. Cold water loft, no hot water, and no toilet. It was all right. Didn't have all the conveniences that one might like, and I wrote a song about that called Don't Worry About the Government. New York in the 1970s is often romanticized. Do you think people get that time period right? Byrne says, yeah, people romanticize the grit and the dirt On some level, it was good because the city was on its knees, so it was ignoring a lot of stuff. There were jazz clubs and discos in lofts in Soho and other places, and the city just turned a blind eye to all this stuff. These places were far from legal, and musicians would live in these lofts and pay very low rent. It's shocking how low the rent was, but that's how funky the neighborhood was, and that allowed all of us to get a foothold. I had a part-time day job, but that was enough for me to contribute rent with the band roommates, so you could make your way. God forbid my parents would have visited. Question: what was your dream when you were living in that cold water loft? When I moved here, my ambition was to be what we called a fine artist, an artist who would show up in galleries and things like that. But the kind of art I was doing, phew, I wasn't getting anywhere with it. I did these questionnaires and surveys. Some of the things were very conceptual. I think there was a single line on a big piece of paper, but it was in the exact shape of the New Jersey Turnpike. You can imagine a little bit of an uphill climb to get to that to go, but I was really enjoying doing that. The music stuff, I thought, this is fun, but don't get your hopes up. There are really great musicians out there, great singers. There's people who are a lot better than you are. Question: you're at a point now where you can make a record and you know it will be rapturously received. Has it always felt like people understood what you were doing? He replies, oh no. There was a period, it might have been in the early 90s. I worked with Latin musicians, did a couple of records with those musicians, and toured. Had a great time. It was pretty well received in Latin America, which was a relief, but in the United States, as one of the executives at Warner Records said, David, you are your own Yoko Ono, which is unfair to Yoko, but I know what he meant. If you wanted to be a conceptual artist, maybe being your own Yoko Ono wasn't so bad. Exactly, Byrne laughs. But he meant more like, you have purposely alienated your audience. Question: when did that start changing? Byrne says, probably about 10 years ago, something like that. Suddenly a younger generation started to be interested in the new things I was doing. It wasn't just the people who grew up listening to Talking Heads. There was a whole other group that was listening. That changed things. Lots of younger artists cite you as an influence today, from Lorde to Hayley Williams. They really look up to you. Are you comfortable being an object of hero worship? I don't like to think of myself that way, but if people like what I do, I'm not going to argue with that. I'm not going to have some psychological issue with that. But for the most part, I'm excited about what I'm doing at the moment, whether it's a record or a tour or something else. And maybe that's a big reason why some of these people like what I do. They see that I've gotten myself into a place where I have a certain amount of freedom to try things out and do different things, which is rare in the music world. Your performance of Burning Down the House with Olivia Rodrigo was one of the coolest moments at Governor's Ball this year. How did that come together? Byrne says, I saw her show at Madison Square Garden months before. She's a great performer, and she was having a really good time. You could tell. I got introduced to her afterwards, and she seemed like a real person. Someone who, growing up in the world that she did, survived it really well. So then, out of nowhere, comes this invitation. "Hey, would you like to join me at Governor's Ball?" My reaction was, "Yeah, and shall we figure out some choreography together?" Question, which you did. You and she really had the moves down. Yeah, we worked it out in a couple of days, Byrne says. Did you ever get to work with an older artist you looked up to when you were younger? Oh, yeah, Byrne says. When we were starting out, we were big fans of the Velvet Underground. John Cale and Lou Reed came to see us at CBGB. We met with Lou Reed a couple of times. He wanted to sign us to a management production deal. But it was a little bit too much like, "Oh, I don't know if we're ready for this." We pulled back. John introduced us to Brian Eno on our first trip to London, and that proved to be a big deal for us. All these people that we were in awe of. "What was Lou like?" Byrne says. "We were playing through some of our songs, just strumming a guitar. And I remember he was showing us how if you slowed some of them down a little bit, that might not be the worst thing in the world, rather than trying to blurt out all the words really quickly. So yeah, he had some good ideas. I remember when we met, he was eating an incredible amount of ice cream. I think he went through two of those quart containers of Häagen-Dazs ice cream in one sitting. We were like, whoa." Question. "You have a song on this album called I Met the Buddha at a Downtown Party, which is another great title." Byrne says, "There were a few songs where it maybe had the first couple of lines or maybe just the title. I Met the Buddha at a Downtown Party." And I go, "Okay, that's like a short story. What happens next? What did he look like? What did he say?" And so it starts to write itself. You just let it go and try to keep it interesting. I have other ones that I never managed to turn into songs. There was one called The 50-Foot Baby, and the baby was wreaking havoc everywhere, just smashing things and picking up cars and tossing them around. Like Godzilla, but a baby. But I didn't know exactly where to take it. Maybe for the next album. Yeah, I'd never done that before, I don't think. So that was new, writing these little stories. You talk about writing these songs as a process of asking questions. Did you reach any conclusions? Byrne replies, "I can't think of any. The more I do this, the more questions there are." You go, "I thought that was going to get an answer." And the door opens or the curtain parts and you go, "Oh my God, it's just a whole bunch more questions and a whole bunch more things that you don't understand." And you wonder, "Am I ever going to get any of this figured out?" Maybe not. We've talked in the past about feeling different from other people, being neurodivergent or on a spectrum. Where's your thinking on that now? I think very, very little of that remains in me. But yes, at a certain age, I felt very socially awkward, uncomfortable. I was and still am able to focus on a song or drawing and just shut out everything else. I enjoy being with my friends, but there's times when I'm alone, and I'm okay with that too. So yeah, there's elements that persist, and I'm okay with it. But it's a lot less than it used to be. And some of that, I think, is just age. You can change over the years. Some of it, I think, is due to what music can do to you, whether it's somebody else's music or your own. Some of it's working with other musicians and band members. That becomes this very healing social situation, and part of it is the joy of making music. That's this big thing that pulls me out of it. You made this new album with the producer Kid Harpoon, who's known for making pop records with people like Harry Styles and Miley Cyrus. What made you want to work with someone like that? Burns says, I like the sound of those records that he made. I know that the subjects I choose, the kind of songs I write, are not the same as a lot of those records. But at the same time, I feel they're still pop records. They adhere to a pop music structure and sound, and they have choruses that you can sing along with. So, why not? When Stop Making Sense was re-released in September 2023, how did it feel for you to see your younger self on screen? When A24 was preparing to re-release Stop Making Sense, I remember going to a screening to see the new print. I hadn't seen it in years. I'm watching, thinking, who is that guy? Sounds like the new record, but I'm looking and going, he's really serious. I feel like telling him to loosen up a little bit. Take it easy, take it easy. It's going to be okay. And by the end of the movie, he kind of does. When you were promoting that re-release, you spent more time with your old bandmates and talking heads than you had in a very long time. And Burns says, that's true, yeah. What was that like for you to be back with that group of people all those years later? It was okay. We were all very proud of that show and the film that Jonathan Demme did. We were thrilled that audiences still wanted to see it. So we put aside whatever differences we have. I said, okay, we're not going to go there, but we're going to help promote this thing. Your bandmates said some unflattering things about you in the press before that. Tina did an interview in 2022 where she called you a bully and compared you to Trump. How did you get over that? Mercifully, I didn't read a lot of that stuff. I'd hear about it a little bit, like you just told me. I also know that there were periods when we made Stop Making Sense where I had this vision of what this show could be. And I probably wasn't the easiest person in the world to work with because I was very single-minded about, no, the lighting should be like this, and the crew has to rehearse wheeling those risers out so that they're as much a part of the show as the band is. It all worked, but I was not the easiest person to work with in those days. Now I know how to collaborate a little bit better. There's a way to do it where it doesn't hurt feelings. In all that time you spent promoting the re-release, were the four of you able to get back to some of the friendships that you had in the earliest days? Byrne replies, did we feel more comfortable with one another? Yeah, we felt more comfortable with one another. But I'm just going to anticipate your next questions. I didn't feel like, oh yeah, let's go out on tour again, or let's make another record. Musically, I've gone to a very different place. And I also felt like there's been a fair number of reunion records and tours, and some of them were probably pretty good. Not very many. It's pretty much impossible to recapture where you were at that time in your life. For an audience, that was formative music for them at a particular time. They might persuade themselves that they can relive that, but you can't. Do you understand why people want a Talking Heads reunion? I totally understand it. I'm a music fan like other people, and there's artists that stopped working or bands that broke up that I heard at a period in my life where music was very important. Maybe I never heard it when it was happening. I missed it. I would love to see it live now. But you realize you can't turn the clock back. When you hear music at a certain point in your life, it means a lot. but it doesn't mean you can go back there and make it happen again. You're at a point in your career where some people might start thinking about a farewell tour or retirement. Is that something you think about? Byrne replies, "No, I haven't thought about it. I've thought about other things. Fred Armisen convinced me to try doing some stand-up, which I did, unacknowledged, and it kind of worked. That is one of the scariest ever, because you're just alone with words for the most part. I don't know if I'm ready to go there, but you never know." "You actually went to a comedy club and did a stand-up set?" "Yes, I did. It's a thing that he organizes where he has guests, but they're not announced. And as with comedy clubs, nobody's allowed to use their phones or anything like that." And the final question, "So you can't find it on YouTube?" Byrne says, "Nope." I'll move now to reviews and an essay titled, "How Justin Bieber Pulled Off the Weirdest Comeback of 2025. Just when most people had written him off, the troubled pop star delivered his best album ever. By Rob Sheffield. For Justin Bieber, it's the ultimate question. What went right? He's the comeback kid of the year with a surprise blockbuster on his hands with Swag, his first new album in 4 years. It's the last thing anyone expected, the most adult, ambitious, relaxed album of his life, not to mention his best ever. Yet he's also standing on bigger business than ever, right when everyone was betting on this guy to fall on his face. Swag debuted at number 2, right behind Travis Scott, the first time Bieber's released an album that didn't enter the charts at the top, yet still the biggest streaming debut of his career. It's a historic resurgence for Bieber, since he's had quite the year full of bizarre celebrity antics, paparazzi run-ins, and social media meltdowns. Most people were ready to write him off as washed up at 31, a former It Boy with a bright future behind him. But it turned out Justin Bieber wasn't falling apart. He was taking the biggest swing of his life, and bouncing back with the pop flex of the year. How did this happen? The last time a star pulled off a rebound like this, it was Britney Spears in 2007 with Blackout, another album by a troubled former child star in the midst of full-blown career chaos, acting out in public, dismissed by the industry as a guaranteed flop. Yet, like Britney's album, Swag turned out to be a brilliant, gimme more career peak, culturally and creatively. As Brit would say, it's Bieber, bitch. It's a shocker, since he's racked up more "Is This Guy Okay?" headlines in 2025 than most celebs manage in a career. There's been relentless gossip about his marriage to Hailey Bieber, especially since they became parents last year, as he kept posting social media rants with a cry for help vibe. "Don't you think if I could have fixed myself, I would have already?" he posted in June. "I know I'm broken. I know I have anger issues." He talked about struggling to address these issues, but it just keeps making me more tired and more angry. Since his 2021 hit Peaches, the Biebs has kept making the news, but for everything except his music. He abruptly canceled a year's worth of shows for his Justice World Tour, saying, "I need to make my health the priority right now." He fell out with manager Scooter Braun, who discovered the 13-year-old Canadian kid in 2007 singing on YouTube severing their longtime bond. In the 4 years after Justice dropped in March 2021, all he managed was a couple of guest appearances. He looked like just the latest sad celebrity burnout casualty. Like Britney, he's been mega-famous for well over half his life, yet coping skills seem to get tougher for him, not easier. Everyone assumed the closest he'd come to a hit this summer would be the viral clip where he yells at the paparazzi, "It's not clocking to you that I'm standing on business." He's been leaving posts where he appears to smoke blunts, as well as an Instagram story with the joke, "This fool never sees my FaceTime ass." The fool was Stevie Wonder. These aren't customarily the moves of a big-name pop smoothie who's got his act together, but in retrospect, they look like a guy who wants to set his past on fire, rejecting the slick polish of his earlier career. His last couple of albums were pleasant but bland, so it looked like he'd made his final, fully impressive album 10 years ago with Purpose. But swag blows purpose out of the water. It's a DGAF declaration of independence from a grown-up artist who's stepping off the treadmill. He gets experimental with left-field demos like the acoustic sketch Zuma House or the bluesy Glory Voice Memo. They sound like they could have been recorded on an old iPhone. Maybe even the same one Andre 3000 used to record his piano solo album. You do remember Andre's piano solo album, don't you? Bieber started out as a child star, the kind of kid who'd show up on the VMA's red carpet with his pet snake named Johnson, plus a very bewildered-looking date, poor Selena. But even in his youth, he was obsessed with the idea of change and evolution. "I was a player when I was little," he sang in a 2009 track on his first EP a lifetime ago. "But I'm bigger." That's right, he was only 15, yet already hooked on the roller coaster ride of the sin confession redemption cycle. He ends his album with Forgiveness, just as he ended previous ones with virtuous meatballs like Believe, Pray, and Purpose. That's why he fills swag with his spoken word therapy session skits with the comedian Drewski, coming clean about his failures and insecurities while his therapist just tells him, "You start smoking these Black and Milds with me, you'll feel way better." Thanks, Drewski. Are you taking new clients? Few stars have ever had a year full of public drama like Justin Bieber, but few have risen above the drama with such an about-face success. He leaves no doubt about where he is standing. On business, with both feet. Now I'll continue with reviews and the magic and mystery of Big Thief. One of the best bands in indie rock travels wide open inner spaces on its spellbinding sixth album by John Dolan. Early in the sixth album from Big Thief, the band's singer-songwriter, Adrian Lenker, misses a flight. For most of us, this wouldn't be anything but a hassle. She turns it into a dream. "Driving with my lover," she sings against distant guitar shimmer and agile circular drumming. "We added up the hours to see the lupine flowers. Way up past the border, we blew through Thunder Bay." The song spirals into a beautiful meditation on memory, time, family, aging, and freedom that's at once casually philosophical, wisely ironic, funny, sad, resilient, and poignantly titled Incomprehensible, a phrase she repeats like an awe-inspired mantra as the song fades. That's a lot to encompass in a 4-minute indie rock tune. But Big Thief have always been a band that likes to travel. They've become one of the most beloved bands of the 2020s because of moments like this. Songs grounded in folk music's rustic beauty and freewheeling honesty that are also spacious sound worlds. They started out as a promising band in the mid-2010s, with influences like Rilo Kiley and Crazy Horse, and hit a peak with the 2019 album UFOF, with Lenker and guitarist Buck Meek creating pastoral acoustic weaves that could suggest a shoegaze John Fahey. Big Thief's last album, 2022's Dragon Noir Mountain, I Believe in You, was a wide-roaming 20-song collection that felt like overhearing a creative community in full bloom, the perfect antidote to COVID-era isolation. At the heart of everything they do has always been Lenker's highly poetic songwriting, which hit a new intimate peak on her 2024 solo acoustic album, Bright Future. Double Infinity is their first LP as a trio. Lenker, Meek, and drummer James Krivchenia, plus longtime producer Dom Monks. It's the product of long periods of improvisation and features a host of collaborators who join in on everything from live tape loops to keys to zither. The finished product is just 9 songs, but the band covers a ton of ground, both in terms of what it comes up with musically as well as the distance Lenker traverses in her writing. On Words, she sings about the struggle to communicate in a relationship. The song starts out as a buoyant folk-pop jam jaunt, upbeat enough to soundtrack a hacky-sack circle in a 1990s college quad, and then immediately gets weirder, darker, noisier, and woozier. Words are tired and tense. Words don't make sense, Lenker sings, her voice rendered a quavering echo as she's falling into the music. The Neil Youngian country rock tune, Los Angeles, is about a relationship that stays tight despite time and distance. The scene shifts from a lonely L.A. night to Park Avenue in New York, and then to the Grand Canyon, as Lenker follows the chords of memory to the point where they reconnect. We dream our dreams together, even without lying in the same bed, she sings. The album's live in the studio real-time creative texture makes for an immersive listen, and sometimes a surprising one. With a smooth, soulful groove, All Night, All Day feels closer to R&B than rock, with Lenker delivering a viscerally impassioned hymn-like ode to romance that opens with, All night, all day, I could go down on you. Hear you sing your pleasure. And continues with, You scratch my skin to help me feel, 'cause I ask you to. The title track is a sublime slow-core power ballad, a hymn to beauty in a world of chaos. No Fear crawls along for 7 miasmic minutes. It sounds a little like if Lowe did a blues rock record with Daniel Lanois. The album's sweetest moment is Grandmother, a collaborator with New Age artist Laraji. Lenker digs into a well of memories, conflicted feelings, and epiphanies, addressing her mother and grandmother, and apologizing to a lover before landing on the refrain, "Gonna turn it all into rock and roll." They make grandma rock into a hell of a genre. Another new old look from a band that keeps making history. John Dolan rewards Big Thief, Double Identity with 4 stars. Also receiving 4 stars from John Dolan is Wolf Alice, The Clearing. The title of the article is Wolf Alice Want to Grow Up and Rock Out. The UK band Wolf Alice have been making eclectic pop rock for a decade, but they've never put it together with the sweep and depth of their 4th album, The Clearing, steeped in classic influences like ELO, Guns N' Roses, Fleetwood Mac, and Carole King. Singer-guitarist Ellie Rosewell goes all in on huge 80s-style rockers like Bloom Baby Bloom, while delivering serious emotional impact on softer moments like Safe in the World. At the heart is Rosewell's ambiguous search for direction and meaning as she moves into the real part of adulthood. I want to settle down. Oh, to fall in love. But sometimes I just want to F-word, she sings. On Just Two Girls, going out for drinks is more about chill friendship than partying, while the moving ballad, Play It Out, reflects on the hard trade-offs that come with getting older. I want to age with excitement, feel my world expand, she sings, sounding bravely unsure as to what that means. In the tradition of King's Tapestry or Stevie Nicks' Belladonna, this is a great album about the scary experience of honestly figuring out what kind of person you are and what the world owes you for the hard work you already do. I'll move now to a tribute to Brian Wilson, 1942 to 2025. A songwriter of towering talent and rare sensitivity. The Beach Boys' founder was all about music, and his music was all about love. By Jason Fine. When my father died about 10 years ago, Brian Wilson called to console me. I gotta give you some advice, and it's not going to be easy to hear, he said. He reflected on his own father's passing in 1973 and said he'd never gotten over it. As bad as it feels to lose your dad, it's never going to get better. But that's how you know you love him and he loves you. That's how you stay connected. Brian gave me a lot of his own special kind of advice over the years. Once, he told me that I needed to shave my beard because it made me look lazy. When we'd exercise at the park, he would often walk about a third of the way around the loop, then lead me toward a bench. He'd say, "You're looking a little worn out. Want to sit down so you can rest?" On drives to Malibu, he would scold me to get gas even if the tank was 3/4 full. When you get older, you'll learn not to take so many chances in life, he said. I got to know Brian at a rather incredible, actually miraculous, time in his life. After so much suffering for so many years, he got out of the prison his controversial doctor, Eugene Landy, had created for him and married his beautiful wife, Melinda. Brian finally received proper mental health care, restored his relationship with his daughters, Carney and Wendy, and started a new family with his adopted children, Daria and Delaney, Dylan, Dakota, and Dash. At the same time, he put together an incredible band to record and tour for the next 25 years. Around that time, I started working at Rolling Stone. I made it part of my job to write about Brian, on the road, in the studio, at home. I had grown up entranced by the Beach Boys. Endless Summer was the first album I ever checked out of the Laguna Beach Public Library at age 8, and I was proud that my hometown was mentioned in the song Surf and Safari. But something deeper drew me in, too. I was a shy and sensitive kid, and I related to Brian's ballads like In My Room, which helped me understand that even amid the waves and sunshine of Southern California, some people, like Brian, felt lonely and misunderstood. His music consoled me. It made me feel less alone. Somewhere along the way, we became friends. I learned that far from the damaged and reclusive artist he was often portrayed to be, Brian was brilliant, sensitive, kind, and hilarious. He cared deeply for his family, lived to travel the world with his band, took so much pride in his kids, loved to laugh and go on little adventures. A perfect day for him was simple. Go to the studio, then go out for a ribeye and a Caesar salad, maybe some creme brulee. What Brian accomplished from 1998 until his death in June was courageous and monumental. The body of work he created in his last decades showed his resilience, humility, guts, and fragility. Most of all, it showed the rest of us hope. There is not one person who ever came to a concert who didn't leave feeling blessed by the music and by a feeling that life can be hard, but we are all in it together. A few summers ago, Brian and I were sitting in the car in his driveway, the AC set to 66 degrees, when California Girls came on the radio. I thought he'd turn it off, as he often did when Beach Boys songs played, but instead he turned it up. He wanted to listen. After it ended, he sighed, "My greatest song. How am I ever going to compete with that?" He explained that the idea for the intricate construction of California Girls came to him in the days after his first acid trip in 1965, which was a scary experience and one he came to believe triggered the auditory hallucinations that tormented him for the rest of his life. He didn't say this with any negativity. In the typical Brian way, he only saw the upsides. "I have this fantasy that the voices in my head helped me write songs. They push me to write great songs." I asked him if he had the chance to do it over again, would he choose to take the acid and write the songs, or not take the acid and possibly not write those songs, but maybe also not suffer as much. He didn't have to think about it. "I take the songs, Jason. What choice do I have? If I could have had an easier life without the songs or a harder life with more creativity, I take the harder life. Because it's all in the name of love. That makes the hard times and the hard work worth it." This was Brian in his soul. He was about music, and his music was about love. The last time I visited Brian, this past March, he didn't feel like going to Malibu or to Musso and Frank. He wanted to stay home and listen to music. The first thing he asked to hear was "Be My Baby." He smiled and sang along, almost as if he was hearing it for the first time. I had asked Brian often over the years if he understood how his music had made people happy, eased their sadness, even saved lives. His answer was always hesitant, deflecting. "I hope they like it," he might say. That day in his living room, I asked him in a different way. I asked if he recognized that the joy he felt from Be My Baby was the same feeling his music gives people all over the world. Brian took that in, and he looked at me with clear blue eyes. "I have tried to bring positive vibrations into the world," he said. "I know how much my music means to people." This was the last thing Brian ever said to me, and it was clear that he understood how much his music consoled and lifted us. It was clear, too, that surrounded by the love and acceptance of his family, his friends, and his band, Brian felt safe and that he had finally found some peace. Well, that is all the time we have for today. This has been Christine with Rolling Stone. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library.